Kevin McCullough Radio.
It's nothing short of an attack on women's basic human rights and civil rights. And it's something that women of America are going to have to fight against with everything they've got.
Okay. What about the women that disagree with you, Kristen Gillibrand? Really? Women are going to have to fight with everything they've got. Well, what about women who just don't see it the way you see it, Kristen Gillibrand? She's talking about the Alabama abortion ban that's basically going to end abortion in that state. I don't know all the details of the legislation, but it's going to be the most pro-life. And guess what? It's going to the Supreme Court. That's my feeling right up front. Let's get some thoughts on this from one of those independent women that Kristen Gillibrand deigns to speak for. She's a fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. She's a reporter for the Daily Signal, doing a fantastic job there. She's also a writer. She writes also for the Daily Signal, also for thefederalist.com. She's a podcast host of the Problematic Women podcast, and she's with us each week at Kevin McCullough Radio. Kelsey Bowler, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So, what do you, like, roll your eyes when you hear Kristen Gillibrand say that?
This is so frustrating. So there's basically two laws, one passed in Georgia, and the governor signed that into law, which basically
the heartbeat bill.
Most abortions,
right.
Exactly, after 6 weeks. And then this one in Alabama, the governor has yet to sign it, but obviously it has the left in a frenzy. And what is so frustrating when you hear the way that they attempt to push back and fight against this legislation is they make it seem like it's a women's issue. And it's women's job to come out and fight against it, when in reality, there are millions of women who support these laws, who identify as pro-life. Almost as many women as men identify as pro-life. And just to give you an idea, it's interesting to look at these two laws in the context of what we saw happen in New York, which is enabling abortion basically up until the point that the baby
after,
is in the birth canal.
After birth, the baby
right,
gets delivered, we can still kill it in New York.
Right. We're now having conversations about infanticide, which is very frightening, I think, from a moral perspective, obviously also from a legal perspective. But 6 in 10 Americans Americans identify as pro-choice, but they want abortion limited to the first trimester.
Right.
So, you know, the majority of Americans are in this gray space, in this middle area where they want to restrict abortion early on. And what the Democrats are pushing is the exact opposite. It's obviously no longer about safe, legal, and rare. It's about abortion at any time, at any point. And so these laws that you're seeing from the opposite perspective come from the pro-life movement are going to challenge that. And yes, very likely will end up at the Supreme Court.
Well, and, you know, Kristen Gillibrand should be careful what she wishes for, because that court looks a lot different than it did when her guy was in there a few months ago.
Absolutely. And, you know, these aren't the only laws that could end up there. We also have laws involving when a baby can feel pain in the womb. And that really presents a challenge for the Supreme Court, because we're talking about, you know, Roe v. Wade is based on babies' viability. And as science continues to improve, it enables babies in the womb to survive outside of the womb at younger and younger stages. So how do our laws reflect that? How do they keep up? I'm really interested to see them take on a case involving that 20-week abortion, pain-capable.
Yeah, the pain-capable acts are great. The heartbeat bill is great, because all of that stuff was not addressed in Roe. Roe decided that it was human biological material, but they couldn't ascribe life or personhood to it, because they chose to remain fuzzy in the understanding of it. Science has come so far since 1973 that most incoming freshmen classes, Kelsey, you know this, you've reported on it, they've seen their brothers and sisters in utero long before they ever met them in person. So you've got a generation or more of people that have gotten used to seeing people before they were born.
Right. And that's why you do see the pro-life movement gaining momentum. The left tries to pretend it's the opposite, but polls will tell you that more and more Americans are identifying as pro-life. And I think that's because that's what the science reflects.
Yeah.
So it's very hard to argue. You know, the party of science is constantly trying to argue against science when it comes to abortion. It can be very frustrating, especially for pro-life women who are constantly ignored in this conversation. It's like we don't matter. We don't have an opinion or perspective. It's if you're a woman, you have to support abortion, which is just absolutely not true, according to all the polls.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. New York City and Philadelphia, within the last 2 weekends, held two of the largest pro-life gatherings, one a little more spontaneously in Philadelphia, had about 1,000 or more people when they expected maybe a few dozen. And then in New York, we had 20,000 people when the New York Post said there were 400. And, you know, Kelsey, I've said it. I think I've said it to you. I've said it on the show many times. I think 2020 is going to be blue states getting bluer, and in places where they are blue, that's going to get very dark blue and much more rigid in terms of the extremism. But I think red states are getting redder. And I think that some of those red states are Rust Belt states. And I think that when you talk to church-going union members in Michigan about whether or not the child that has survived a birth procedure should be allowed to be killed in the doctor's office or in the hospital post-birth, I think they just like, who are these loony people that live in, you know, these places where they do this stuff? What kind of cannibals now inhabit the cities of you know, the blue states?
Right. I think any conversation surrounding abortion bubbles down to one simple question, and that is, when a woman finds out she's pregnant, what is that inside of her? It, you know, according mm-hmm. to all the scientific books, it is a human being. And if you acknowledge that, why is it okay to kill a human being? And it's such a fundamental question that unfortunately the mainstream media doesn't press Democrats and activists on the left and on enough to really question, you know, if that is a human being, then why is it okay to murder? It's obviously not okay to murder human beings outside the womb. So why is it okay to do so inside?
No, that's where that whole infanticide discussion falls on its face for the left, because they have to acknowledge not only is it human DNA, it's distinct DNA from its mother. It's not the same person. So you're not just getting rid of a lump of cells or, you know, a cyst or something else. This is an actual human being that has a separate identity all the way around. Okay, real quickly, you had some interesting thoughts about Don Trump Jr. in this morning's Bright email, going back in front of the Senate Judiciary, or is it? No, not Judiciary, the committee that's
Intelligence.
What's your take on that?
You know, I am surprised that Donald Trump Jr. agreed to this, but it sounds like they did put in some pretty strict requirements on the length of the time he's willing to testify and the types of questions that he is willing to answer. He's already testified for, I believe, 9 or 10 hours in front of the same committee. You know, we know Lindsey Graham thought he absolutely should not go back and testify, but he was facing a subpoena, and, hopefully they reach some sort of compromise and we can move on, because we do know that most Americans, if they did read the Mueller report or if they didn't, they're ready to move on. There's nothing found there. And this is just yet another example of, unfortunately, Republicans actually had this committee. So this is an example of Republicans.
Yeah, I don't get Burr. Burr doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, real quickly. Breakfast is a social construct. What are you talking about, Lady Bowler?
This is an interesting article that all you listeners should go read at The Atlantic, talking about the history of breakfast and why Americans eat such a limited variety of food for our first meal. It also looks at different countries and what their breakfast consists of. In other countries, I just experienced this when I was in Thailand. They're eating, you know, pad thai for breakfast. That's very normal. They'll eat the same things that they eat for lunch and dinner for breakfast. In fact, like dumplings that we often associate here with only dinner, they sometimes only serve them as an option at breakfast in Asian countries. And it really reflects sort of the privilege that we have as Americans to eat such a small variety of food where everyone else kind of eats what they have in front of them.
Yeah.
So I think it's just an interesting, fun read to learn about the history of breakfast.
It
and
was.
How it's evolved in America.
I learned something from it. And friends, you can get it from the Bright Email. She edits the Wednesday edition, and you can get that at getbrightemail.com. Kelsey, my best breakfast ever that I've ever had, Israel. You wake up in the morning, all the salad buffets that they have laid out, all the produce and all the quinoa and everything else, that the couscous and all the other stuff. Great, great breakfast in Israel. I'm big, big advocate of it. Anyway, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm going to try that out.
Follow her on Twitter. Read her in the Daily Signal. She's a fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and we're honored that she's part of Kevin McCullough Radio. Coming back, Kristen B. Tate's in the green room, standing by. Don't go away.